while the laundresses fell into apologies before the great man, realizing their fire had sparked the ignition, and perhaps expecting punishment. But the general kindly reassured the women before coming up the steps of the porch where we stood.
"Are you unharmed, sir?"
I asked, noting his weariness. His hair was much grayer than it had been when I'd first met him in Morristown. More so than the hair I wore in the pendant round my neck.
"Quite, Mrs. Hamilton, but your concern is appreciated," he said, reaching for the door to return to his work, as if nothing remarkable had just occurred.
Noting the pallor of Mrs. Washington's face, I gave her hand a reassuring squeeze.
"Thank you, dear,"
she whispered with an appreciative glance, then stepped inside with the general. The quick exchange made me wonder who Martha Washington, so often without female companionship while in camp, had to confide in and rely upon. Perhaps it wasn't my place, but I'd consider it a privilege to call Mrs. Washington my friend. A moment later, Tench rode up to the house, eyes bulging at the sight of the scorch marks. When I told him what happened, he shook his head.
As if the weight of the whole war didn't already lie upon his shoulders, now he's literally putting out fires.
It was a sentiment that stuck with me. One I shared with Alexander when he returned from his duties that night to our little room at the boarding house, his hair ice-crusted and his cheeks raw from the wind. But not before I helped him remove his sodden cloak and draped it near the fireplace. "Can I get you something hot to eat or drink?" He peered over his shoulders at me as he opened his satchel and pulled out a thick sheaf of papers.
"Your very presence warms me, my love. My travels kept me from finishing today's correspondence, so I must attend that before I can sleep."
"Of course." Moving quietly about the small room, I readied for bed. The crackle of the fire and the fast scratches of Alexander's quill were the only sounds in the dim room. Kneeling at the hearth, I added two logs to the blaze, then held out my hands to soak in the heat when, on a sigh, Alexander stamped a seal against the page and then set the letter aside.
"I saw something quite remarkable today,"
I said, having waited impatiently for him to finish. "General Washington single-handedly put out a fire upon the shed at the headquarters." Alexander turned in his seat.
"So I heard."
"I saw him run to put the fire out. I didn't even know he could run. He's always so dignified."
"It sounds as if this made quite an impression on you,"
Alexander said after a long moment. Then he frowned and got up to pace, his expression suddenly stormy.
"Perhaps you would hold me in such regard if I received an appointment or command benefiting my talents."
My stomach dropped.
"Oh, but I admire you more than any other."
When he didn't answer, I asked,
"Have I said something to upset you?"
Alexander shook his head, rueful.
"No, I'm sorry. It's only that I've engaged in military service since the beginning of 76. I began in the line, and had I continued there, I'd be in a more advanced rank than I now am."
"Of course,"
I said, realizing the cause of his peevish agitation. Alexander worried over his future, over our future. He threw himself back into the chair.
"And yet here I sit, writing letters of introduction for John Lawrence while I am yet again passed over."
I felt a little nauseated for him. That an appointment he wanted went to his friend both soothed and salted the wound.
"Alexander, you will receive a command."
"When? Damn it, Betsy, I have yet to once merit the confidence and esteem of the man you admire so much."
His raised voice echoed in the small space. The quiet that followed was just as loud until I could no longer tolerate the space between us. Going to him, I rested my hands on his chest. I opened my mouth to tell him that of course he had the confidence and esteem of Washington. Why, the great man relied upon him more than any other, and hadn't he heard Washington's term of endearment at dinner?
But sensing Alexander didn't want to be thought of as anyone's boy, not even Washington's, I looked into his fiery blue eyes and simply said, I love you. I admire you in every way a woman can admire a man, more than any other man. I meant that sincerely.
Though now, in the fullness of years, I realized that what I felt was only a fraction of all that I would feel for him. That the love I felt then was of a simple, unalloyed, untested kind. That like a captain navigating a new river, I didn't know Hamilton yet. Not the breadths nor depths of him, nor the rocks upon which we might run aground. He softened as he gazed at me, and then he tenderly leaned his forehead against mine. Forgive me, my angel. You don't deserve my ire.
I will ease you however I can, I said, realizing that this was one of the things Alexander needed from me as his wife, and something I could easily provide. Soft comforts against the hard realities of our war-torn world. An attentive ear, a warm touch, kind, encouraging words. Heat slipped into his eyes again, but not the heat of anger.
You always do, he said,
kissing me like he did all those nights of our honeymoon.
And now I think it is time for bed.
Mutiny! Mutiny! Mutiny!
The shout carried to us from some crier in town, and my husband came fully awake, leaping from the bed to yank on breeches and boots, while I was still rubbing sleep from my eyes. A moment later, McHenry was pounding on the door, and my shirtless husband threw it open, perhaps forgetting entirely that I was in bedclothes or in the room at all. Fortunately, Max seemed not to realize it either.
It's the New Jersey line, he said grimly.
Where?
Hamilton barked. 50 miles out, Mac replied. They broke against their officers and are marching on Trenton to demand that the state legislature redress their grievances.
50 miles away. Better than here, I thought. Marching to demand the pay, clothing, and supplies they were rightly owed by a state that recruited them to war was better than deserting or going over to the British. Maybe my husband thought so, too, because his motions to dress became less frantic. But Mac clapped him on the back and said,
Saddle up, lad. The general thinks we made a mistake negotiating with the Pennsylvania mutineers. He means to go after them this time, before it spreads like a contagion.
Mac started to go, but my husband called after him.
Grab that crier by the ears and give him a knockabout, will you? The fewer people who know about the mutiny, the better.
Mac nodded, then was gone as soon as he'd come. Meanwhile, I found my husband's shirt in the bed linens and tossed it to him, at which point he colored at realizing my presence and my state.
1,000 apologies, Betsy.
Don't make even one, I said, understanding the urgency. Did McHenry really mean that you're going after them?
Hamilton nodded. We'll stop the mutineers before they get to Trenton, and this time we'll make an example of them.
I bit my lip at the horror of American troops fighting American troops, feeling a little disloyal to my husband and to Washington, because it seemed to defy all notions of justice. These mutineers had sacrificed so much and suffered for so long. Did they not have the right as free men to petition their government for redress of their grievances? They wanted nothing more than what any human being seemed due: food, shelter, clothing. Freedom. The thought of punishing them for it unleashed a pain within my chest. A pain that worsened to know that my own husband might have some part in their punishment. And though I said nothing, he must have seen that pain in my eyes. Buttoning the collar of his shirt, Hamilton asked,
What happens when the mutiny isn't 50 miles away, but here at headquarters? As it is, Lafayette is afraid to leave General Washington alone, for fear that disloyal troops might turn their coats and hand him over to the British.
They wouldn't, I said, only because it was treachery too black for my heart to even contemplate.
Maybe not, my husband said. but we lost more than 1,000 soldiers in the negotiations with the Pennsylvania Line when they were released from their enlistments. We can't lose any more men, not when Arnold is unleashing hell on Virginia.
Benedict Arnold. I couldn't hear the name without erupting into a fresh rage. That traitor knew everything. Our strengths, our weaknesses, our strategies, maybe even our spies. He'd already burned Richmond for the British, looted it, and sold off the plunder for his own financial gain. There was seemingly no end to the depravity of which Arnold was capable, nor the damage he could do. I hated him for all that, for John Andre's death, and for having compromised my father, too. But now, I had further reason. Good patriots were going to hang or be shot, at least in part, because of Benedict Arnold. And my husband's hands would be stained with their blood for the rest of his life. As if to steel his courage against it, Alexander eyed me beseechingly and said, "I hate Congress, the army, the world, I hate myself. But we must hold this army together."
"I understand," I whispered as he stooped to kiss me goodbye. And I did understand after a fashion. I remembered that he'd said it before at Morristown, when I asked him if it was right to torture that poor deserter. He'd defended himself then by saying that he hadn't given the order. But this time, he might. He would, in fact, ride out that very same day with Lafayette and Washington for the trials that would condemn several mutineers to execution. But before he left, Hamilton stopped in the doorway and stared at me where I sat fighting back tears, and his own voice thickened with emotion.
"When the fighting is done, I will make this a better world, Betsy. I promise you."
An audacious vow no mere mortal should make. A vow born as much of egotism as of idealism, as much self-justification as godliness. But young and hopeful as I was, I believed him. I put my faith in him. And at least in that, I was right to. Because whatever else he did, Alexander Hamilton did make this a better world. He kept that promise. In truth, he spent his life keeping that promise. Chapter 11. February 16th, 1781. New Windsor. It was, at long last, time to make a stand. After the mutinies had been put down and their leaders executed, all the men were weary and anxious for the coming and hopefully decisive battle with the British. For almost a year now, the French general Rochambeau's fleet had been blockaded in Rhode Island. Now he was ready to abandon his ships and march his well-equipped and well-trained French soldiers with ours in what we all hoped might be the decisive battle for American independence. All that remained to be decided was when and where we would fight. In the deciding, Alexander was gone many nights until well after the fire had died and I'd fallen asleep. I'd taken a terrible cold, and so had poor Colonel Tillman, who forged on with his work anyway. For myself, in the most secret part of my heart, I was terrified. I believed in our soldiers and our cause and our chances. But from what I overheard at headquarters, it seemed that we were now racing week by week, headlong toward a battle from which there could be no retreat or stalemate. This time would be for all the world. Win, and nothing would ever be the same. Lose, and, well, my husband, my father, my family, my friends, we stood to lose everything. Knowing what was at stake, I didn't mind my husband's late hours. What alarmed me was Alexander's arrival to our room in the middle of the afternoon. I'd never before seen him so distressed. Sitting up in bed, where I'd been endeavoring to rest away a headache and a sore throat, I ran my gaze over him, trying to determine what could be wrong. Slamming the door, he stomped inside and threw his satchel to the floor. His cloak followed in a great flourish of dark fabric. All the while he muttered and cursed to himself.
Slipping out of bed, I wrapped a blanket around my shoulders, and he came straight to me. His blue eyes stormy.
You shouldn't get up. You need rest.
But
there's been an unexpected change,
he said, a strangeness to his voice, a wildness to his expression.
I am no longer a member of the General's family.
I almost couldn't make sense of the words. I don't understand. He pulled me to sit on the edge of the bed.
General Washington and I have come to an open rupture. He accused me of treating him with disrespect.
My husband's tone was equal parts anger and dismay. I took his hand. You? Disrespect his excellency. I cannot imagine it. Tell me what happened. Alexander squeezed my hand and then rose. For a moment, he stared into the fire and then he began to pace, as he so often did when agitated.
There is very little to tell. He asked to speak to me and I nodded, then continued down to hand Tillman a letter. The Marquis asked me a question to which I gave the most concise of answers because I was impatient to return to the General.
Hamilton heaved a breath, his hands raking at his auburn hair.
But instead of finding Washington as usual in his room, I met him at the head of the stairs. Do you know what he said? That I'd kept him waiting 10 minutes and had treated him with disrespect. Can you imagine?
Alexander whirled on me.
I sincerely believe my absence didn't last 2 minutes.
Of course, I said, my mind racing. It was just a misunderstanding. Surely this can be remedied.
No, it cannot.
He shook his head.
I argued that I was not conscious of any disrespect, but since he thought it necessary to tell me such, we should part. He agreed, so here I am.
Alexander had barely finished recounting the tale when a knock sounded upon our door. My husband crossed the room and opened it, the rusted hinges creaking in protest. And I heard Tillman's voice from the other side.
General Washington has sent me. May I come in? I don't think so, sir. My wife is indisposed.
Alexander gave a curt nod and made to close the door. I was aghast at his rudeness. I am perfectly well, I called, not willing to let him use me as a rationale for not resolving this disagreement. And I was becoming accustomed, at this point, to my husband's colleagues bursting in upon us any hour of day or night. Invite poor Tillman in to get warmed by the fire. After a pause, my husband relented, and the colonel entered and gave me a bow, even as a coughing fit had him clasping his chest. Let me get you some raspberry leaf tea with honey, I said, pouring from the pot I'd made myself downstairs at the boarding house's hearth.
Thank you, Mrs. Hamilton. You're too kind.
Tillman accepted the cup. Meanwhile, Alexander seemed impatient at all the niceties, but I paid him no mind. I hope you bring good news from headquarters, I said, giving Tillman a meaningful look. And I imagined I saw in his eyes a mutual understanding. This must be fixed. While it did sound as if His Excellency had been in ill humor, Alexander had never before responded with such stridency. They were both simply overworked, overburdened by the weight of the war and the coming battle. Sipping at the herb tea, Tillman addressed my husband.
Sir, General Washington bade me to reassure you of his great confidence in your abilities, your integrity, and your usefulness to him. He wishes nothing more than to reconcile. He explained that his terseness came in a regrettable moment of passion and that he is sorry for it.
Relief flooded me. Given the circumstances, how could tempers not flare from time to time? And how gracious for a man of General Washington's stature to be the one to offer amends. But my husband remained silent and didn't seem at all relieved, not even when Tillman continued.
He wants a candid conversation to settle this.
Alexander crossed his arms.
Neither of us would like what would be said in a candid conversation.
He shook his head, resolution settling into his handsome features.
I won't refuse if he insists, yet I should be happier if he would permit me to decline.
I barely withheld a gasp at this outrageous reply, and Tillman blanched, overcome with another coughing fit.
You won't even speak with him.
My husband's voice turned to steel.
I pledge my honor to you that he will find me inflexible. He shall, for once at least, repent his ill humor.
At hearing this, Tench set down his cup hard on the side table and abandoned every last vestige of his usual formality.
Alex, what the devil can you be thinking?
It was precisely what I wished to ask.
For pity's sake, man, you know the situation at headquarters. I do.
Hamilton replied stiffly.
But don't worry that I'll leave it all upon your shoulders. Reassure the general that I won't distress him or the public business by quitting before Humphreys and Harrison return from their assignments. I will comport myself with the same principles and in the same manner I always have. My behavior will be as if nothing happened. But I am quitting.
Poor Colonel Tillman left wearing a stunned expression that must have mirrored my own. My mind raced for a solution. So much hung in the balance, for us personally and for the cause. Could it all be undone by my husband's pride? Alexander, I said, cupping his cheek in my hand as I carefully chose my words. Of course you didn't deserve the general's shortness, but he recognizes his error. Surely you can forgive.
It's more than that.
As if trying to reassure me that he wasn't simply caught in a fit of temper, he pressed a kiss to my palm and grasped my hand in his.
I never wished to be an aide-de-camp. I never wished to depend entirely upon any one person for my future. I had refused to serve in this capacity to two other generals for just this reason. But I got swept up in the enthusiasm of the war and an idea of Washington's character and accepted his invitation.
I understood this. But now seemed hardly the time to change course. Before I could say as much, Alexander rushed to add,
Washington has always professed more friendship for me than I felt for him. You've seen how he calls me my boy. I need to stand upon a footing of military confidence rather than of private attachment. So today has been a long time in coming.
Queasiness overcame me, for this stand seemed utter folly. Was there any other young patriot in the country who wouldn't trip over himself to win Washington's fatherly affection? And yet my husband apparently resented it as much as if it was offered by the father who'd abandoned him. Not knowing whether to feel sympathy or exasperation, I only managed a soft, "Oh, Alexander." He shook his head again.
"Worry not, dear Betsy. I will re-enter into the artillery. Or perhaps a command in the infantry will offer itself. Either way, a command would leave me the winter to prosecute the study of the law in preparation for my future career in life. Either will leave me in a better position than if I stay in service in the general's family.
I still couldn't believe that my husband meant to abandon his crucial place in the war effort as Washington's most trusted aide, not with the war at a turning point. And yet Alexander immediately set quill to paper to inform my father and a few close confidants of his breach with Washington, the sharing of which might well embarrass our commander, making their parting irrevocable. I tried to imagine Papa's reaction, an endeavor that made my headache worsen. What would he think of his new son-in-law, who, having achieved the security of our family reputation and fortune, nearly immediately and in a moment of pique, insulted and abandoned George Washington? There must be some way to fix this. So, despite the sharpening soreness in my throat and the agony of facing Martha Washington when our husbands were now at odds, I went to headquarters with Alexander the next day, working with her as I always did and sitting in quiet observation, hoping some opportunity might arise for me to smooth over this rift. True to his word, Alexander conducted himself that day as if nothing untoward had occurred. But Mrs. Washington knew better. Sitting beside me in the farmhouse's parlor as we wrote letters requesting funds for the soldiers, she spoke quietly, never lifting her gaze from the parchment.
"Have you had the opportunity to meet the woman in camp they're calling Captain Molly?"
Mrs. Washington was referring to the wife of a cannoneer who, during the Battle of Monmouth, had been bringing pitchers of water to the soldiers when her husband fell. To avenge him, Captain Molly took his place at the cannon with admirable courage and service. I'd seen the stout, red-haired, freckle-faced young woman in camp, but I'd never spoken to her.
I'm afraid we're not acquainted.
Should we be?
Martha's lips pinched for a moment. It's just that she puts me in mind of something. If our independence is to be won, our husbands must be willing to put themselves in harm's way. But achieving independence also relies on the support of our women, in whatever manner best supports the cause.
My quill paused, and I looked up at this wise lady from whom I'd already learned so much. In whatever manner? I asked, willing her to say more. Her brown eyes clear, her graying hair framing her round face under the plain mop cap, she said, Even great men require advisers, and we have our husbands' ears. Sometimes we encourage, sometimes we challenge, and sometimes we manage.
I couldn't imagine how a man like Alexander might be managed, but perhaps she could.
I returned my quill to the inkpot and sat back in my chair.
How?
She smiled, shaking away the sand we used to dry the ink. Then she poured a circle of wax upon the page to seal it.
If I could tell you that, perhaps the war would already be done.
I suspected she had somehow managed General Washington into offering an apology, and now it was up to me to get Alexander to accept it. But I felt ill-equipped for the task. Martha Washington was, in my mind, the ideal of a true woman. More amiable and diplomatic than my own beloved mother, Martha had for more than 20 years worn around her finger a plain wedding band that symbolized her devotion to, and perhaps her influence over, her husband. Whereas I was a newlywed and still learning how to influence mine. Foundering as if in a canoe without a paddle while I did it. And the one person who seemed as frustrated as I felt was Lafayette. That afternoon, when taking Munch to the back room, where my husband labored over the general's correspondence, I overheard the Frenchman cry,
Mon Dieu, the feud I started by accident. My dear Hamilton, how I wish I hadn't stopped you to talk when the general needed you. I make all the apologies.
No one blames you, my friend,
my husband replied.
Better to blame me than His Excellency, Lafayette said stoutly.
I hesitated just outside the slightly open door, riveted by our friend's effort to talk sense to Alexander.
Your being angry with him will pass, Hamilton. But trust in someone who has tender sentiments for you. If you quit this army now, you will be angry at yourself the rest of your life.
I held my breath, because my husband had said nothing to me of quitting the army itself, only Washington's service. Whatever Alexander replied was too muffled to hear, but the Marquise's unusually soft tones were just audible.
Then make me a promise. Do not resign your commission. If nothing better can be found, come fight beside me and Monroe in Virginia and command our artillery. Like old times. I will not go until you agree.
I withdrew to the kitchen, not wishing to be caught eavesdropping. How was I to make all of this better? When Hamilton seemed intent on making it worse. Some moments later, Lafayette surprised me when he walked in, nearly banging his head on the copper pots hanging from the rafters.
Madame Hamilton, you marry a most obstinate man.
So I'm learning, I said, immediately afraid I'd been disloyal. But how was I to save my husband from behaving with recklessness, pride, and even arrogance? Lafayette gave a rueful smile as he leaned in.
Brilliant men are often the most stubborn, but to pick a quarrel with Washington.
He shook his head, and his amusement melted away.
Some would say this to be folie de grandeur, but in Hamilton I know this to be a mask, and allowances must be made for his circumstances.
His circumstances? I asked, fearing he might raise the issue of Alexander's legitimacy. Instead, he said,
Great pain and loss, madame, as I think you know.
I did know.
but I was a little amazed that Lafayette did, too. And even more so at the sudden intimacy of our conversation.
My own father was killed when I was not yet 2 years old, the Frenchman explained. But still I had money and relations to look after me. Your husband had no one to look after him. Small wonder he trusts no one but himself to care about his future. Not Washington, not me, not anyone, I think. Maybe not even you.
I never wish to depend entirely upon any one person. That's what Hamilton had said. And I realized how well Lafayette understood his fears. Martha Washington had advised me to manage my husband's self-destructive impulses. And now I hoped Lafayette might help me do that. Maybe you could talk to him again in a few days, when he's had time to reflect.
Perhaps we can conspire together to make him see reason, oui?
Lafayette replied.
I can only write him letters because I march shortly to defend Virginia, with orders to capture Benedict Arnold and hang him dead by the neck.
With a bloodthirstiness I'd never felt before, I said, in that endeavor I wish you very well, sir. Still, Lafayette spoke of his new southern command a little glumly, for we all believed the final battle would take place somewhere in New York, and he didn't wish to miss it.
It is probable I will be in the southern wilderness until the end of the war, so if Hamilton will not return to Washington, convince him to join me. We will share our exile.
I wasn't certain that a loving wife should convince a husband who had dedicated 6 years of his life to war that he should endanger himself even one more day, but I was sensible to Lafayette's argument that Alexander would never forgive himself if he didn't see the war to its conclusion. Nor was I even sure we could win this war without Alexander Hamilton. For these weeks at his side in camp had revealed to me the military side of the man. He was forever identifying weaknesses in enemy movements, formulating strategies about which he convinced the general before communicating them to the commanders in the field, haranguing Congress for what support the army received, negotiating with the French, and finding clever ways to stretch the army's resources, all while unburdening Washington so he could focus on the whole of the war. So I agreed to give Lafayette's suggestion long thought. You're a good friend, I told the Frenchman, and I wish you the fondest adieu.
Non, non, Lafayette cried before taking his leave. We will say only au revoir until we meet again. In the meantime, I wish you luck with your campaign to keep your husband from rashness. As for me, I would rather face the cannons.
Chapter 12. April 1781. To Paister's Point, New York. 2 months later, I wondered if I would not have fared better against cannons myself. Martha Washington's advice had helped me to see that my soft words and touches could moderate my husband, at least a little. By making of myself a soothing presence, I gently persuaded Alexander to accompany the general to Rhode Island to serve as interpreter in the strategy discussions with the French officers, for Alexander's mastery of the language exceeded that of all the other American members of Washington's staff. I accomplished that much. But after that, Hamilton left Washington's service, just as he said he would. And now he appeared to be taunting our commander. His Excellency had refused my husband a promotion, partly on the grounds that he was indispensable at headquarters. Well, now, we were gone from headquarters, but living in a little brick-and-stone house directly across the river from Washington's dwellings. Our new home at De Paister's Point, our first household together, was little better than a fishing shack, without so much as a dining table. It was drafty, the roof leaked, it stunk of dead fish, and the only way to get to it from headquarters was by way of a little rowboat. But it had one winning feature as far as my husband was concerned, namely, that George Washington couldn't look out his window without seeing us there. Day in, day out. Our presence, in plain sight, was to remind the general that Alexander Hamilton was available for a promotion, but until he got one, he would remain just out of reach. For my part, I'd promised that I would live anywhere with Hamilton, and I took genuine pleasure in transforming the shack into our home. This was not, after all, a boarding house where we must be careful not to move anything. No, this was the first place I might decide for myself how to arrange our few sticks of furniture, where to store silver, where to hang linens, and what to store in the larder, for we had no servant with us to do it for me. And not even Mama would swoop in and dictate how everything should be. So, armed with bucket, a brush, and some precious lye soap acquired at far too great a price, I cheerfully scrubbed our new home from floor to ceiling. I made countless trips to the river to get wash water. And when I hung my petticoats on the line, I'd wave quite ruefully to Martha Washington across the way, imagining she was doing the same. It was all a great deal more challenging than I expected. The fire needed to be tended all day if we were to have anything to eat, and having never managed a household by myself, much less attended to all the chores, there were a few mishaps. My first attempt at cooking fish resulted in a charred mess and a burned hand. "This is no place for my gently bred bride." My husband said this while kissing my blistered fingers, as if to make them all better. Then his eyes fell upon the wash bucket where I'd been on my hands and knees, scrubbing mud from the floor. And later that night, when I collapsed in an exhausted heap beside him in bed, he asked, "Why don't you return to your father's house in Albany before he sees what I've reduced you to?" "Because you aren't the only one with too much pride," I thought. My Aunt Gertrude had said I was no milk and water, miss. Well, I wasn't about to be a milk and water wife, either. Others make do with less, so can I. I don't want to leave. My place is at your side in service of the cause. Besides, I could hardly make him see reason if I was far away.
"So you are a Roman wife," he said,
more than a little pleased.
"But I'm not entirely without hopes we'll soon have peace. Then you must submit to the mortification of enjoying mere domestic happiness. This I know you will not like, but we cannot always have things as we wish."
I laughed at his optimistic teasing, then said, "Martha Washington stays with her husband through hardship, and I intend to stay with mine." By mentioning Mrs. Washington, I also hoped to remind him of all the people who sacrificed their comfort and personal desires to remain at Washington's side. But what he seemed to take from it was a reminder that Martha Washington had servants and I did not. A thing remedied the next day in the form of a young enslaved Negro woman Alexander hired from her master. Though I was happy for the help, I didn't know if we could truly afford a servant, and was surprised to feel discomforted at being entirely in charge of supervising one. I'd grown up in a house run using the labor of slaves. But they'd always been Papa's slaves. Certainly, they'd tended to me, but as a child living under my father's roof, I'd not been given a choice in that. Now, I had a choice. Though she'd only been temporarily hired out to us by her owner, this was the closest I'd ever come to being a slaveholder in my own right. And I found that I did not like it. I did not like it at all. Not when I thought about the black soldiers at Morristown. Not when surrounded by soldiers preparing to die for the cause of liberty and independence. In any case, I didn't share my misgivings with my husband, because he'd done me the kindness of giving me exactly what he'd thought I'd wanted and needed, likely against the pangs of his own conscience. I was only just beginning to see the inherent contradiction between the ideals we said we were fighting for and the reality of slavery in our daily lives. Hamilton had opened my eyes to it, but I wasn't sure what to do about it. We were, I suppose, both of us, still a ways from a full awakening. It must not be thought that Hamilton was idle at De Peyster's Point. Quite the opposite. While my servant and I cooked and cleaned and caught fish in the cold brackish water, Hamilton cast about for any sort of opportunity fortune might cast up.
Not only pestering Washington near daily to give him command of troops, but also writing other generals too, in the hopes they had some leadership role for him in the forthcoming campaign.
He even wrote to my brother-in-law, who apparently informed Angelica of his ambitions, such that she became anxious to exert her own influence on his behalf.
"Good news,"
Alexander said one day, as he came rushing in the door, tramping spring mud all over the floor. Rain had fallen for two straight days, causing the river to overflow its banks and making of our yard a quagmire.
"Betsy, if you will hear..."
I held out a hand before he could cross the room. "I would love nothing more than to share in your good news, my dearest husband, after you've removed those boots." A stack of books and papers in hand, he appeared completely confused, and he finally peered down at himself as if he'd momentarily forgotten he had feet. With a chuckle, he juggled his load and pulled the tall boots off, and I wondered if he'd finally been given his command. But Alexander said,
"Congress has acted as I hoped they would. Robert Morris has been appointed as superintendent of finance."
My husband had not been much impressed in early March, when the Articles of Confederation were finally ratified, thinking them far too weak a system. But now he was hopeful and nearly vibrating with excitement.
"Finally, we shall have men of the first abilities, property, and character in charge of the departments of the executive."
I smiled and said how wonderful it was, though this was not the sort of news that excited me. And as he sat, I took in the pristine spines of books sprawled across the table to find a series of what appeared to be philosophical texts on government and economy. Price's Observations on the Nature of Civil Liberty, in two volumes, Hume's Political Discourses, Postlethwaite's The Universal Dictionary of Trade and Commerce, Buse's Lex Mercatoria Redivivia. Given this reading material, I was happy to leave him to it. But when I returned a short time later, I found that he'd discarded his coat and loosened his cravat. Ink dotted his fingers and smudged his cheek, and his hair had the appearance of having been blown by the wind from the way he raked his hands through it when deep in thought. "What are you working on so feverishly?"
"A letter of congratulations to Mr. Morris," he said,
working with an intensity I'd never seen in another. Not even my father. His focus unwavering, his quill scratched fast against the page. It was strangely enthralling to watch, utterly appealing. I blinked at the stack of thick leather tomes and what looked to be at least 10 pages of writing. A very long note of congratulations, I should say.
"Well, I'm also sending him my thoughts on the topic of establishing our economy,"
Hamilton said with the same nonchalance with which another might talk about the weather or the price of tea.
"Betsy, if we win this war, we turn to the great project of building a nation where none has yet existed. Rarely does mankind have such an opportunity, nor such a burden. We must get it right."
Clearly, Hamilton believed he knew how to get it right. And I listened as he told me all he'd learned of world finance when at the age of 14, he worked as a clerk at an export and import company in St. Croix, trading sugar, timber, cattle, and even slaves. I hadn't realized he had such a passion for finance, or really, that anyone could have such a passion for it. Truthfully, it was a passion I didn't share. But I listened in rapt attention, because it was one of the few times Alexander ever spoke about his childhood and the hard lessons it impressed upon him. Lessons he was very keen to impart to his new country. Even then, as a starry-eyed newlywed, I feared there might be some manner of hubris in a lieutenant colonel with no expertise in finance, other than his own experience as a 14-year-old clerk, condescending to write the new superintendent of finance an economic manifesto. But at the time, having mostly witnessed the soldier in Hamilton, I was also much intrigued by the scholar. More importantly, his enthusiasm for the project of building a nation, for thinking ahead,
helped give me much-needed courage that we would win this war. And with a little hubris of my own, I asked, "Is there something I can do to help?" He'd already refused a bowl of fish stew for dinner, as if he couldn't take even a moment away from his pan in exchange for a spoon. And now he was rubbing with one hand at the back of his neck, as if it pained him. When he glanced at me, quizzically, I suggested very tentatively, "I see that you're copying your notes and calculations. Maybe I could do the copying for you."
"You want to write for me?"
he said, arching a brow.
"Like a clerk?"
"I should rather be your long-suffering and extremely loyal aide-de-camp," I replied.
He smirked at my impudence. "Your simmering disapproval of my decision to leave the general is duly noted."
I started to object, but he held up a hand.
"That was not a point subtly made, my love, and I intend to thoroughly punish you for it by accepting your offer."
I felt a little thrill of excitement. When I'd thought of his being partner, I never imagined being so directly involved in his work. To be a patriot in heart and sentiment, but also in deed and ink. "Just tell me what to do." Before long, I had a stack of pages in front of me. While Alexander wolfed down his dinner and worked out more calculations, I copied his notes for hours, concentrating on penmanship, until my eyes glazed over from recording lengthy discussions of generating revenue, paying for the military, currency depreciation, foreign credit, and instituting a national bank. But his long, complicated calculations made me think of Papa's love of equations, and I smiled at the comparison. When I had written my 12th full page, I set down the quill, but found that my hand had cramped in a curled position. I laughed as I rubbed at my palm and fingers.
"How do you do it?"
Hamilton's brow furrowed.
"Do what?"
"Write so much. Some days the only time you're not writing is when you're asleep. Why, I've even seen you writing while saddled upon a horse. Yet after just a few hours at the task, my hands feel as though I've suddenly developed rheumatism." He frowned and made as if to set aside his work.
"I'm sorry, love. You don't have to continue."
"No. Please," I said, smiling. "I want to help. I only mean to convey my admiration, Alexander. You are remarkable, truly." Slowly, he settled back into his chair.
"Remarkable? How?"
"Oh, Mr. Hamilton, what I'd known of you pales in comparison to what I've learned this night. Why, I begin to think you're a genius.
And I say this as the daughter of a man who has always delighted in calculations and equations and theory and philosophy.
I may not understand all your work, but I recognize the cleverness, no, the brilliance behind it all the same." And it was true, because to my mind it appeared that Alexander was in the process of single-handedly laying out the foundations for everything the American Union might yet become— of creating the better world he'd promised to create. That might have been the proud wife in me speaking, but I didn't think so. His brow lifted, as if in surprise, but then wariness settled into his blue eyes.
"Are you still teasing me, Betsy?"
"No, my dearest. I'm trying to tell you that in spite of my simmering disapproval of your decision to leave the general, I am so very proud of you." Alexander ducked his chin and cleared his throat, as if embarrassed or overwhelmed by my compliment. Had no one ever said such a thing to him before? Or had no one made him believe it? I couldn't resist the urge to make sure he knew the truth of my feelings. I moved to him, crouched by his knees, and peered up into his handsome face. "I am so very proud to be your wife." He grasped my hand hard where it rested on his leg, and when he looked at me, His gaze was filled with a depth of gratitude that made me fall a little more in love with him, and it stirred a longing in my body. Tentatively, I reached for him until I captured his mouth with mine. The soft contact was like putting a match to kindling. It unleashed something within him. In truth, within us both. He took me to our bedroom, whispering,
"I need you, Betsy. How I need you."
Warmth bloomed inside me at the sentiment, and then flared hotly as my husband grasped at the material of my skirts.
"I just need..."
We came together desperately, frantically, but I'd never felt more loved and cherished. Afterward, he turned to me, his arm cradling my neck.
"I wish I'd met you earlier, that you'd been at home that first time I visited your father in Albany. I wish I knew you even when you were a girl."
"You wouldn't have looked twice at me then," I teased, though I believed it to be true.
"You're wrong. I'd have loved you and wished to learn everything about you. I'd have tried to be worthy of you that much sooner and been a better man for it." "You ease me, Betsy. My mind races, but your touch calms me. My thoughts fly, but your presence allows me an escape. I want nothing more than to please you in return. In your eyes, I wish to be the most amiable, the most accomplished. And when I'm not, I will endeavor to make up for all I lack with love."
I pressed my lips to his. "You are the most amiable." I kissed him again. "And so very accomplished." Again. "And even more handsome." How strange it was to reassure a man whom every other woman in the world seemed to desire. His smile grew as humor slid into his gaze.
"How handsome?"
I feigned exasperation with a roll of my eyes, but couldn't hide my grin. "Are you fishing for more compliments?"
"From the mouth of my angel. Always."
His touch turned hungry once more, and his lovemaking that night won me over again and again with the belief that Alexander Hamilton, this brilliant, complicated, flawed man, needed me. And I needed him, too. Heeding Lafayette's words, I'd done what I could to encourage him to return to Washington's service. But now I thought better of it. If my husband wished to resign his commission in the army, I would encourage him to do so. Because I had now glimpsed the statesman in him, and I knew he would blaze a trail of glory in whichever path he chose. Besides, it was much safer, I thought, to be a statesman than a soldier. How naive I was.
"Well, you've finally done it, Ham," said Tench Tillman, with a lingering cough.
With the coming of summer, I'd left the door open to a breeze, and now looked up to find the colonel's height filling the entryway of our home, an expression on his face that warred between admiration and annoyance.
"You've forced the great man's hand."
"What?" Hamilton asked, rising up hastily from the table where he was composing political essays on the defects in the Articles of Confederation. But Tillman, perhaps vexed that he'd been forced to cross the river in a rowboat just to deliver this news, was in no hurry to satisfy my husband's curiosity. Instead, he turned his attentions to me and grinned, tipping his hat.
"I shouldn't have been so long without seeing you, Mrs. Hamilton."
He glanced out the window at the river he'd just rowed across.
"It's only that your jealous husband put an actual gulf between us."
I laughed and offered to have our servant fetch him some porridge. But Alexander thumped the table impatiently.
"Out with it, man. What news?" "Washington is not about to let you resign your commission, as you've tacitly threatened to do,"
Tillman replied, and I could see that was the part that annoyed him.
"So you're getting your command."
My husband tensed.
"Tell me."
"A New York light infantry battalion."
The glee that broke out on Alexander's face defied all description. He was, thereafter, in a celebratory mood, and invited Tench to stay for a meal. The next morning, my husband was eager to meet with the generals about the long-awaited battle, and left early, finally, and at long last, crossing the river back to headquarters. And I was absolutely nauseated over the thought of him finally going off to fight. I couldn't tolerate my breakfast, and could only nurse a cup of tea until the nausea passed. It took 3 days in a row of this same discomfort before I counted back to my last monthly courses, and it finally dawned on me. I was pregnant. I was going to have a baby. I debated when to tell Alexander about my suspicions, wishing to be more certain before I raised his hopes. But my husband forced my hand, just as he'd forced Washington's. To take command of his troops, Hamilton needed to ride south, and this time he couldn't have me with him. We'd all assumed that the summer campaign would take place in New York, but new intelligence from Lafayette, which I later learned had come from a Negro spy the Marquis had recruited, suggested that we might better gamble it all in Yorktown, Virginia. Whichever choice was made, Hamilton would have to be ready to ride into battle in an instant, which meant we had to say our goodbyes. Oh, God, what if he doesn't come back? What if he never meets his child? As I had this thought, my husband came immediately to my side.
"Betsy, dearest angel, what is it? You've gone so pale. Are you still unwell?"
"No," I said, gulping a deep, steadying breath. "Well, perhaps a little." Alexander frowned.
"I'm calling for the doctor, but let's get you to bed first."
"That's not necessary," I said, letting myself be pulled from the chair. "Alexander..."
"I'll row out and retrieve him right away," he said, a tinge of panic to his words. "It won't take long, I promise."
"I'm not ill," I said abruptly, rushing to allay his fears. "I'm pregnant." Alexander froze. As my announcement sank in, my hands went to my belly. His gaze followed, and then he was looking at me with the purest expression of wonder I'd seen on any man's face.
"You're pregnant."
"You're going to be a father," I said, heart beating hard against my breast. Slowly, Alexander placed a hand atop my own, and when he lifted his eyes to mine, they were glassy with joy and awe.
"I'm going to be a father."
Smiling, I nodded. And then we were laughing and embracing, even as Alexander asked 100 questions and insisted all over again that I needed to lie down. That night, I whispered into the darkness, "Whatever happens, you must come back to me. To us." Alexander pulled me tight against him.
"Oh, Betsy, it costs me a great deal to be absent from you, but I promise we won't be separated for long."
I tried to believe him. The next day, as he put me in the carriage for my father's house, his expression a mask of regret, he said,
"I miss you already."
"As do I miss you." Tears stung my eyes, but I wanted to be strong for him when all his focus needed to be on the coming fight. "I love you," I said, then insisted more fiercely, "Come back to me."
"I will," he whispered, his voice strained.
He closed the door and tapped on the side of the carriage, and it lurched to a start. And I could only hope that in having unleashed the forces of war, my husband would not, like Phaethon, be struck down for hubris in his quest for glory, our dreams of the future mere ashes for me to mourn. Chapter 13. August 1781. Albany. Our army would risk everything in Yorktown. There, in Virginia, Lafayette had somehow cornered the British general, Cornwallis.
and success relied upon the trustworthiness of James Armistead, the black spy who was posing as a runaway slave in the British camp and feeding Lafayette critical intelligence. Papa, who was privy to the strategy, seemed confident of victory. And I tried to be, too.